Good evening, folks, and welcome back to Eldritch Times. Tonight, I was thinking of recording a story. Of course, another H.P. Lovecraft story. He just has most of the best pulp science fiction. And I was thinking of reading The Other Gods, a short story which must be about the other gods. So, let's begin. Atop the tallest of Earth's peaks dwell the gods of the earth, and suffer no man to tell that he hath looked upon them. Lesser peaks they once inhabited, but ever the men from the plains would scale the slopes of rock and snow, driving the gods to higher and higher mountains, till now only the last remains. When they left their older peaks, they took with them all signs of themselves, save once, it is said, when they left a carven image on the face of the mountain, which they call Grinnec. Now that they have betaken themselves to unknown Kadath, in the cold waste where no man treads, and are grown stern, having no higher peak whereto to flee at the coming of men. They are grown stern, and where once they suffered men to displace them, they now forbid men to come, or coming, to depart. It is well for men that they know not of Kadath and the cold waste, else they would seek injudiciously to scale it. Sometimes when Earth's gods are homesick, they visit in the still night the peaks where once they dwelt, and weep softly as they try to play in the olden way on remembered slopes. Men have felt the tears of the gods on white-capped Thrai, though they have thought it rain, and have heard the sighs of the gods in the plaintive dawn winds of Lyrian. In cloud ships the gods were wont to travel, and wise cotters have legends that keep them from certain high peaks at night when it is cloudy, for the gods are not lenient as of old. In Ulthar, which lies beyond the river sky, once dwelt an old man avid to behold the gods of Earth, a man deeply learned in the seven cryptical books of Earth, and familiar with the narcotic manuscripts of distant and frozen Lomar. His name was Barzai the Wise, and the villagers tell of how he went up a mountain on the night of the strange eclipse. Barzai knew so much of the gods that he could tell of their comings and goings, and guess so many of their secrets that he was deemed half a god himself. It was he who wisely advised the burgesses of Ulthar when they passed their remarkable law against the slaying of cats, and who first told the young priest Atal where it is that black cats go at midnight on St. John's Eve. Barzai was learned in the lore of the Earth's gods, and had gained a desire to look upon their faces. He believed that his great secret knowledge of gods could shield him from their wrath, so resolved to go up to the summit of high and rocky Hathaghkla, on a night when he knew the gods would be there. Hathaghkla is far in the stony desert beyond Hathag, for which it is named, and rises like a rock statue in a silent temple. Around its peak the mists play always mournfully, for mists are the memories of the gods, and the gods loved Hathaghkla when they dwelt upon it in the old days. Often the gods of Earth visit Hathaghkla in their ships of cloud, casting pale vapors over the slopes as they dance reminiscently on the summit under a clear moon. The villagers of Hathag saw it is ill to climb Hathaghkla at any time, and deadly to climb it by night when pale vapors hide the summit and the moon. But Barzai heeded them not when he Barzai heeded them not when he came from neighboring Ulthar with the young priest Atal, who was his disciple. Atal was only the son of an innkeeper and was sometimes afraid, but Barzai's father had been a landgrave who dwelt in an ancient castle, so he had no common superstition in his blood and only laughed at the fearful Cotters. Barzai and Atal went out of Hathag into the stony desert despite the prayers of peasants, and talked of Earth's gods by the campfires at night. Many days they traveled, and from afar saw lofty Hathaghkla, with his aureole of mournful mist. On the 13th day they reached the mountain's lonely base, and Atal spoke of his fears, but Barzai was old and learned, and had no fears, so led the way boldly up the slope that no man had scaled since the time of Sansu, who is written of with fright in the moldy Nicotic manuscripts. The way was rocky and made perilous by chasms, cliffs, and falling stones. Later it grew cold and snowy, and Barzai and Atal often slipped and fell as they hewed and plodded upward with staves and axes. Finally, the air grew thin and the sky changed color, and the climbers found it hard to breathe. But still they toiled up and up, marveling at the strangeness of the scene and thrilling at the thought of what would happen on the summit when the moon was out and the pale vapors spread around. For 3 days they climbed higher and higher toward the roof of the world. Then they camped to wait for the clouding of the moon. For 4 nights no clouds came, and the moon shone down cold through the thin, mournful mist around the silent pinnacle. Then, on the 5th night, which was the night of the full moon, Barzai saw some dense clouds far to the north, and stayed up with Atal to watch them draw near. Thick and majestic they sailed, slowly and deliberately onward, ranging themselves around the peak high above the watchers, and hiding the moon and the summit from view. For a long hour the watchers gazed, whilst the vapors swirled and the screen of clouds grew thicker and more restless. Barzai was wise in the lore of Earth's gods and listened hard for certain sounds, but Atal felt the chill of the vapors and the awe of the night, and feared much. And when Barzai began to climb higher and beckon eagerly, it was long before Atal would follow. So thick were the vapors that the way was hard, and though Atal followed at last, he could scarce see the gray shape of Barzai on the dim slope above in the clouded moonlight. Barzai forged very far ahead and seemed, despite his age, to climb more easily than Atal, fearing not the steepness that began to grow too great for any save a strong and dauntless man, nor pausing at wide black chasms that Atal could scarce leap. And so they went up wildly over rocks and gulfs, slipping and stumbling and sometimes awed at the vastness and horrible silence of bleak ice pinnacles and mute granite steeps. Very suddenly, Barzai went out of a tall sight, scaling a hideous cliff that seemed to bulge outward and block the path for any climber not inspired of Earth's gods. Atal was far below and planning what he should do when he reached the place, when curiously he noticed that the light had grown strong, as if the cloudless peak and moonlit meeting place of the gods were very near. As he scrambled on toward the bulging cliff and litten sky, he felt fears more shocking than any he had known before. Then through the high mists he heard the voice of Barzai shouting wildly in delight. I have heard the gods, I have heard the Earth's gods singing in revelry on Hathaghkla. The voices of Earth's gods are known to Barzai the prophet. The mists are thin and the moon is bright, and I shall see the gods dancing wildly on Hathaghkla that they loved in youth. The wisdom of Barzai hath made him greater than Earth's gods, and against his will their spells and barriers are as naught. Barzai will behold the gods, you proud gods, the secret gods, the gods of Earth who spun the sight of man. A Atal could not hear the voices Barzai heard, but he was now close to the bulging cliff and scanning it for a foothold. Then he heard Barzai's voice grow shriller and louder. "The mist is very thin, and the moon casts shadows on the slope. The voice of Earth's gods are high and wild, and they fear the coming of Barzai the Wise, who is greater than they. The moon's light flickers as Earth's gods dance against it. I shall see the dancing forms of the gods that leap and howl in the moonlight. The light is dimmer, and the gods are afraid." Whilst Barzai was shouting these things, Atal felt a spectral change in all the air, as if the laws of Earth were bowing to greater laws. For though the way was steeper than ever, the upward path was now grown fearsomely easy, and the bulging cliff proved scarce an obstacle when he reached it and slid perilously up its convex face. The light of the moon had strangely failed, and as Atal plunged upward through the mists, he heard Barzai the Wise shrieking in the shadows. "The moon is dark, and the gods dance in the night. There is terror in the sky, for upon the moon hath sunk an eclipse, foretold in no books of men or of Earth's gods. There is unknown magic on Hathay Kla, for the screams of the frightened gods have turned to laughter, and the slopes of ice shoot up endlessly into the black heavens, whither I am plunging. Hey, hey, at last! In the dim light I behold the gods of Earth." And now Atal, slipping dizzily up over inconceivable steeps, heard in the dark a loathsome laughing, mixed with such a cry as no man else ever heard, save in the phlegethylon of unrelatable nightmares. A cry wherein reverberated the horror and anguish of a haunted lifetime packed into one atrocious moment. The other gods, the gods of the outer hells that guard the feeble gods of Earth. Look away, go back, do not see, do not see. The vengeance of the infinite abysses, that cursed, that damnable pit. Merciful gods of Earth, I am falling into the sky. And as Atal shut his eyes and stopped his ears and tried to jump downward against the frightful pull from unknown heights, there resounded on Hathay Kla the terrible peal of thunder which awaked the god Cotters of the Plains and the honest burgesses of Hathag, Nir, and Ulthar, and caused them to behold through the clouds that strange eclipse of the moon that no book ever predicted. And when the moon came out at last, Atal was safe on the lower snows of the mountain, without sight of Earth's gods or of the other gods. Now it is told in the moldy Nakotic manuscripts that Sansu fought naught but wordless ice and rock when he did climb Hathay Kla in the youth of the world. Yet when the men of Ulthar and Nir and Hathag crushed their fears and scaled that haunted steep by day in search of Barzai the Wise, they found graven in the naked stone of the summit a curious and a cyclopean symbol 50 cubits wide, and as if the rock had been riven by some titanic chisel. And the symbol was like to none that learned men have discerned in those frightful parts of the Nakotic manuscripts, which were too ancient to be read. This they found. Barzai the Wise they never found. Nor could the holy priest Atal ever be persuaded to pray for his soul's repose. Moreover, to this day the people of Ulthar and Nir and Hathag fear eclipses, and pray by night when pale vapors hide the mountaintop and the moon. And above the mists on Hathay Kla, Earth's gods sometimes dance reminiscently. For they know they are safe and love to come from unknown Kadath, in ships of cloud and play in the olden way, as they did when Earth was new, and men not given to the climbing of inaccessible places. Well, that was The Other Gods by H.P. Lovecraft. I have to say, it is very similar to The Strange High House in the Mists and The Evil Clergyman, as it ended with somebody either dying or going mad or changing in physicality completely. But this was good. I've heard some of these names of cities mentioned in other contemporaries of Lovecraft's works. Most notably, I'll say August Derleth, and I think Robert E. Howard has definitely mentioned these places in his Conan stories. And I'm sure it's in Lord Dunsany's work as well, since he was also a contemporary of Lovecraft. Well, that was a short one. That was only about 15 minutes, so let's see if there's another. Well, how about I read one more? So this will be a twofer. It'll be The Other Gods and this story, The Tree, also by H.P. Lovecraft. On the verdant slope of Mount Menalas in Arcadia, there stands an olive grove above the ruins of a villa. Close by is a tomb, once beautiful with the sublimest sculptures, but now fallen into as great decay as the house. At one end of that tomb, its curious roots displacing the time-stained blocks of Pentelic marble, grows an unnaturally large olive tree of oddly repellent shape. So like to some grotesque man or death-distorted body of a man, that the country folk fear to pass it at night when the moon shines faintly through the crooked boughs. Mount Menalas, Mount Menalas. That's quite a mouthful. Mount Menalas is a chosen haunt of dreaded Pan, whose queer companions are many, and simple swains believe that the tree must have some hideous kinship to these weird Panissi. But an old beekeeper who lives in the neighboring cottage told me a different story. Many years ago, when the hillside villa was new and resplendent, there dwelt within the two sculptures Kalos and Musides, from Lydia to Naples. The beauty of their work was praised, and none dared say that the one excelled the other in skill. The Hermes of Kalos stood in a marble shrine in Corinth, and the palace of Musides surmounted a pillar in Athens near the Parthenon. All men paid homage to Kalos and Musides, and marveled that no shadow of artistic jealousy cooled the warmth of their brotherly friendship. But though Kalos and Musides dwelt in unbroken harmony, their natures were not alike. While Musides reveled by night amidst the urban gaieties of Tegea, Kalos would remain at home, stealing away from the sight of his slaves into the cool recesses of the olive grove. There he would meditate upon the visions that filled his mind, and there devise the forms of beauty which later became immortal in breathing marble. Idle folk indeed said that Kalos conversed with the spirits of the grove, and that his statues were but images of the fauns and dryads he met there, for he patterned his work after no living model. So famous were Kalos and Musides that none wondered when the tyrant of Syracuse sent them deputies to speak of the costly statue of Tyche, which he had planned for his city. Of great size and cunning workmanship must the statue be, for it was to form a wonder of nations and a goal of travelers. Exalted beyond thought would be he whose work should gain acceptance, and for this honor Kalos and Musides were invited to compete. Their brotherly love was well known, and the crafty tyrant surmised that each, instead of concealing his work from the other, would offer aid and advice. This charity producing two images of unheard beauty, the lovelier of which would eclipse even the dreams of poets. With joy, the sculptors hailed the tyrant's offer, so that in the days that followed, their slaves heard the ceaseless blows of chisels. Not from each other did Kalos and Musides conceal their work, but the sight was for them alone, saving theirs. No eyes beheld the two divine figures, released by skillful blows from the rough blocks that had imprisoned them since the world began. At night, as of yore, Musides sought the banquet halls of Tegea, whilst Kalos wandered alone in the olive grove. But as time passed, men observed a want of gaiety in the once sparkling Musides. It was strange that said amongst themselves that depression should thus seize one with so great a chance to win art's loveliest reward. Many months passed, yet in the sour face of Musides came nothing of the sharp expectancy which the situation should arouse. Then one day, Musides spoke of the illness of Kalos, after which none marveled again at his sadness, since the sculptor's attachment was known to be deep and sacred. Subsequently, many went to visit Kalos, and indeed noticed the pallor of his face, and there was about him a happy serenity which made his glance more magical than the glance of Musides, who was clearly distracted with anxiety, and who pushed aside all the slaves in his eagerness to feed and wait upon his friend with his own hands. Hidden behind heavy curtains stood the two unfinished figures of Tyche, little touched of late by the sick man and his faithful attendant. As Kalos grew inexplicably weaker and weaker despite the ministrations of puzzled physicians and of his assiduous friend, he desired to be carried often to the grove which he so loved. Then he would ask to be left alone, as if wishing to speak with unseen things. Musides ever granted his requests, though his eyes filled with visible tears at the thought that Kalos should care more for the fauns and the dryads than for him. At last the end drew near, and Kalos discoursed of things beyond this life. Musides, weeping, promised him a sepulchre more lovely than the tomb of Mausolus. But Kalos bade him speak no more of marble glories. Only one wish now haunted the mind of the dying man, that twigs from certain olive trees in the grove be buried by his resting place, close to his head, and one night, sitting alone in the darkness of the olive grove, Kalos died. Beautiful beyond words was the marble sepulchre, which stricken Musides carved for his beloved friend. None but Kalos himself could have fashioned such a bas relief, wherein were displayed all the splendors of Elysium. Nor did Musides fail to bury close to Kalos's head the olive twigs from the grove. As the first violence of Musides' grief gave place to resignation, he labored with diligence upon his figure of Tyche. All honor was now his, since the tyrant of Syracuse would have the work of none save him or Kalos. His task proved a vent for his emotion, and he toiled more steadily each day, shunning the gaieties he had once had relished. Meanwhile, his evenings were spent beside the tomb of his friend, where a young olive tree had sprung up near the sleeper's head. So swift was the growth of this tree, and so strange was its form, that all who beheld it exclaimed in surprise, and Musides seemed at once fascinated and repelled. 3 years after the death of Kalos, Musides dispatched a messenger to the tyrant, as it was whispered in the agora at Tegea that the mighty statue was finished. By this time the tree by the tomb had attained amazing proportions, exceeding all other trees of its kind, and sending out a singularly heavy branch above the apartment in which Musides labored. As many visitors came to view the prodigious tree, and as to admire the art of the sepulchre, as to admire the art of the sculptor, so that Musides was seldom alone, but he did not mind his multitude of guests. Indeed, he seemed to dread being alone now that his absorbing work was done. The bleak mountain wind sighing through the olive grove and the tomb tree had an uncanny way of forming vaguely articulate sounds. The sky was dark on the evening that the tyrant's emissaries came to Tegea. It was definitely known that they had come to bear away the great image of Tyche and bring eternal honor to Mycetes, so their reception by Proxenoi was of great warmth. As the night wore on, a violent storm of wind broke out over the crest of Menelaus. Anyway, and the men from far Syracuse were glad that they rested snugly in the town. Smugly, I guess they kind of were smug. They talked of their illustrious tyrant, and of the splendor of his capital, and exulted in the glory of the statue which Mycetes had wrought for him. And then the men of Tegea spoke of the goodness of Mycetes, and of his heavy grief for his friend, and how not even the coming laurels of art could console him in the absence of Kalos, who might have worn those laurels instead of the tree which grew by the tomb near the head of Kalos. They also spoke. The wind shrieked more horribly, and both the Syracusians and the Arcadians prayed to Aeolus. In the sunshine of the morning, the Proxenoi led the tyrant's messengers up the slope to the abode of the sculptor, but the night wind had done strange things. Slaves' cries ascended from the scene of desolation, and no more amidst the olive grove rose the gleaming colonnades of that vast hall wherein Mycetes had dreamed and toiled. Lone and shaken mourned the humble courts and the lower walls, for upon the sumptuous greater peristyle had fallen squarely the heavy overhanging bough of the strange new tree, reducing the stately poem in marble with odd completeness to a mound of unsightly ruins. Strangers and Tegeans stood aghast, looking from the wreckage to the great sinister tree whose aspect was so weirdly human and whose roots reached so queerly into the sculpture sepulchre of Kalos. And their fear and dismay increased when they searched the fallen apartment. For all the gentle Mycetes and of the marvelously fashioned image of Tyche, no trace could be discovered. Amidst the stupendous ruin, only chaos dwelt, and the representatives of two cities left disappointed. Syracusians, that they had no statue to bear home, Tegeans, that they had no artist to crown. However, the Syracusians obtained after a while a very splendid statue in Athens, and the Tegeans consoled themselves by erecting in the agora a marble temple commemorating the gifts, virtues, and brotherly piety of Mycetes. But the olive grove still stands, as does the tree growing out of the tomb of Kalos. And the old beekeeper told me sometimes the boughs whisper to one another in the night wind, saying over and over again, "Oida, oida, I know, I know." Well, that was The Tree by H.P. Lovecraft. Thankfully, it was located in a book right after The Other Gods, and was much less of a horror story than almost like a parable. But, yeah. So, that was a twofer. My first twofer. And, trying to decide what I want to read next. Let's see. What options do we have? Maybe The Doom That Came to Sarnath would be a good one. Possibly Polaris. But there's some other really great ones in here. The Cats of Ulthar is a good one. From Beyond. Ooh, that could be a good one too. Or The Nameless City. The Crawling Chaos. Oh, there's all kinds of good ones. But it'll have to wait till another time. It was excellent reading to you folks, and I hope you enjoy these two short stories by HPL. Until next time. This was Eldritch Times. Good night. Thank you.